Welcome to New Books in Film. I am your host, Joel Cherney. One of the most popular film quotes of all time is, "I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore." In his book, Mad as Hell, The Making of Network and the Fateful Vision of the Angriest Man in Movies, New York Times cultural reporter Dave Itzkoff examines the film and the career of writer Paddy Chayefsky. The book was published in 2014 by Times Books and reprinted in trade paperback in 2015 by Picador. In my interview with him, Dave discusses his interest in Chayefsky and the brutal history of the making of this prophetic film. Welcome to Dave Itzkoff. Hi, Dave. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks for having me on.
Well, this is your first film-related book, but you've obviously written extensively about popular culture. But let's get some background in. Obviously, you have a busy day job working for the New York Times, writing for the New York Times, but when did you decide that writing was something you wanted to do as a profession?
It's something that's always been part of my life, even as a child. I mean, my parents will tell you stories of how when I was in nursery school and we had a typewriter in the classroom and I got in trouble because I was the first kid who knew how to type all the naughty words, and I was showing my other friends how to do it, and then we accidentally left the piece of paper behind in the typewriter and got in trouble for that. But I would say it's something that really happened much later in life, probably in high school or in college. I mean, I had a few professors who were already in media in different ways, including John McPhee and at the time Terrence Rafferty, who was the one of the film critics for The New Yorker, and they actively encouraged me, and that I think probably made all the difference.
Well, obviously, and the one thing these days with social, with media, digital media and social media, you probably have the opportunity to do more writing than you ever thought you'd be able to, given how some people literally are at it 24 hours, seemingly at it 24 hours a day.
It is interesting, certainly, how I remember, this will date me quite a bit, but getting to college and discovering email and all these kinds of innovations actually sort of bringing back, some degree of engagement with, I don't know if you'd call it a literary culture, but certainly with written communication and that becoming a valuable skill again.
Your first two books are autobiographical in nature, but why did you decide in this case to write a film-related book?
Well, for any number of reasons. I think you can only write so many memoirs, certainly by the time you're, I'm 39 now. I don't think I have another personal story in me at the moment, but also most of the kinds of writing that I've done professionally has been, as you mentioned, about popular culture and certainly with a focus, quite a bit of focus on film and television. And this was, not only was this a movie that, had immense personal value to me, but it was a way to tie in a lot of the history of film and of television in a way that I hadn't seen written before. It certainly eras, not just one era, but multiple eras in both media that I think we certainly now think of as kind of golden ages, both the 1950s and the 1970s. We, to a certain degree, romanticize them as, eras when seemingly much better work was being done, when artists, I think, had more control over what they were doing in these works. And so, all those things just kind of made it irresistible.
And actually, that is part of what you have to say early on in the book of Chayefsky's opinions of what was going on in the 50s, where everybody talked about it being a golden age, and he made some interesting comments about that and whether how true or not true that particular concept was.
Certainly, if you look at his work and frankly a lot of the work that was being done, as I said earlier, we certainly romanticize the period, but the kinds of struggles that the creators were going through then, even when the medium of television was brand new, it's really not all that different from what contemporary writers and producers go up against now. That it's very, very hard to sort of maintain your autonomy and to have sole control over work, and certainly just the influence of everyone from the television networks to your fellow producers to advertisers and sponsors. There's just so many. It's such a collaborative environment, if you want to use that euphemism. There's just so many different ways that a vision kind of gets chipped away at, and often what makes it to the screen is rarely the work of any one person or the embodiment of what that person imagined when they first got into the endeavor. And so that was something that someone like Chayefsky was battling for. Going back to 1953, 1954, and this whole, and nobody even really knows what TV is yet. And it had so few sort of established rules and standards and traditions and certainly very few genres. And yet, he's already very attuned to this idea of, maintaining his personal voice and already feeling frustrated that he can't get that across. Ask any showrunner today if he or she feels any differently.
Of course, I think you're right. You've just pretty much hit the reason why there is some different types of material back in that period is because it's new media. And every time there's a new method of distribution or of showing something or presenting something, there's that period of time. I mean, early internet, early television, sometimes in the movies, early time where people were doing somewhat more unusual things because, for number one, television had all this time that they had to fill and there wasn't a lot there. So they were starting from scratch, so to speak.
Right. And in television, I think maybe more than any other, when we think of that as being so regimented in terms of what television can do, what shows look like. Everything has to have a kind of a genre or a format that it has to fit into, and it's so even now populated by police procedurals and hospital dramas and reality shows, and everything has to kind of fit into a certain niche. And you have to remember that there was ever so briefly a time when it was just this wide open landscape, and you had a few networks that just knew, well, we've got to put up something, and we've got to sell ads against it, and that was really all that they were concerned with at the time. And so at least for a few years, you just had this incredibly kind of fertile period, not only for writers and producers, but also for actors, and so many new voices and faces that emerged at that time, just because it was kind of this gold rush era. If you had an idea or you had even a smidgen of talent, they were interested in you.
So let's talk a little bit more about Chayefsky, though, before we get to the movie in more detail. Most people that know the film would probably know something about him, but I think to an extent he sort of disappeared a little as far as general knowledge of him, even though I think, frankly, he doesn't deserve that. I mean, the material he did, even the small amount, I would say, is... So what was his background and how did he affect his film writing?
Sure. Well, I mean, he grew up in the Bronx, and was not first generation, but the son of first generation Americans, and came from a Jewish household, and they were middle class. They did the father did reasonably well, and he grows up in the 1930s and 40s, and then is participates as a member of the military in World War II, and he's injured in combat. They're not mortally, but enough that he can't continue to fight, and then while continuing as a member of the military, works on some documentaries for the U.S. And then when the war is over, through some of the contacts that he made and in meeting other people who would go on to be or already were established screenwriters and playwrights when he comes back to the U.S. after the war, he basically tries to find his way as a writer. I mean, he works briefly in his uncle's print shop, but mostly is trying to hack it. Really as I think in his mind he wanted to be a stage dramatist and write works for Broadway. But then you have certainly by the early 1950s just the explosion of television, and so he spends a little bit of time adapting other people's works either for radio or for TV, but then pretty quickly becomes a writer of his own material.
The title of the book refers to him as the angriest man in movies, or the subtitle of the book.
Right. And it's a little play. It's sort of a pun or a little inside joke for any reader who comes to the book with any inside knowledge, only because I think most people, if you know Network at all, you certainly know about the anger of Howard Beale, the principal character of the film. But I think it's an anger and a frustration that was certainly shared by Chayefsky for much of his life and career too.
And that was what my second part of the question was going to be. What were the sources of some? Why was he so angry in general as far as his career and his probable belief that he wasn't as successful with what he wanted to do as he probably should be?
Yeah, I mean, there's no one incident that you can hang it on, and as far as I'm aware, no sort of great trauma that occurred to him that made him feel this way. But I think he represents a kind of personality that I think you see they're not uncommon, certainly in the mass media and certainly in any kind of art or entertainment form, and people who just feel things very deeply. I mean, he was somebody who was very attuned, certainly the more his career went on, was very attuned to what he felt were problems in the country and just the ways in which the fabric of the nation seemed to be unraveling. And he just felt that there were just more increasingly insurmountable problems facing the country, facing the world, and that on the one hand he had this really remarkable platform to reach people on a mass scale, and yet that fewer people were actually listening to what he had to say or following the directives that he was trying to give him. I think he had very high standards, and he also just was a very sensitive person and had a real personal sense of dignity and felt a kind of wound or affront anytime anytime he saw anything that he felt went against his sense of personal justice. And there were just so many, certainly by the 1970s, there were so many things going on in the world that set him off in that way.
Of course, that anger tends to come through in his works pretty obviously. I mean, usually the main characters are very quick to show their anger, or you can see it. For example, George C. Scott in the hospital is probably, clearly a good character to have if you want to show anger. And of course, we see it in Hospital, or excuse me, also in Network.
Right, right. And, you can trace it almost all the way back to really the beginning of his professional career. Even in Marty was the work that really was his big breakthrough, both as, originally as a television drama and then later as a film. And that's a kind of, a classic Chayefsky character of somebody who is, very tightly wound, and at least at first doesn't necessarily show their anger or their frustration, but these characters typically get some big moment, usually in the climax of the piece, somewhere in Act 4, where they will just they'll blow up at somebody or something will finally trigger them to unleash whatever it is that they've got inside them, and then it all comes out in one big monologue or some kind of tirade usually, and those are moments like that are very often the turning points in his screenplays, not usually an act of, you know, a violence or a physical confrontation, but usually, you know, something verbal and a big speech that somehow, you know, either turns the tide or it lets you know exactly what the stakes are for this character.
Of course, in Network, we didn't wait till Act 4. We got it, you know, right about in the middle.
yeah, it's true. If you look at the sort of the running time, you get the big the Howard Beale speech, I think, somewhere in the middle of the film.
So let's talk more about Network itself. When did you first see it, and what led you to decide that it needed a book?
Well, I've had trouble kind of placing in my mind when I was first turned on to the movie. I mean, the thing that I remember most vividly is the parody of it that Mad Magazine ran. I wouldn't have even seen it when it was first published. That would have been obviously in 1976 or 77 when the movie came out, when I was, you know, about one year old. I must have seen it in some, you know, kind of reprint collection in the 1980s. And the running joke in that parody is that the language of the movie was so foul that even in Mad Magazine, they can't really represent it. They can't print all those curse words. They have to use all these kind of funny, you know, little comic book symbols and characters to represent it. So, of course, as a, you know, a seven-year-old child or whatever, I was tremendously fascinated to know what were the real words that even Mad Magazine had to sort of bleep out. So I must have, I'm sure I rediscovered it in high school and college and, you know, then really understood, you know, what the messages and the themes and ideas of the movie were that I certainly did not grasp, you know, at age seven, that's for sure. But the decision to write about it, I mean, that was, I just really had a wonderful opportunity, now almost, 4 years ago that the papers of Paddy Chayefsky, the mass of them, are now owned by the New York Public Library, and anyone is, you can go there and request them, and you can see really just about everything, almost everything that he ever wrote down in his life. If you want to see, you know, crossword puzzles that he worked on when he was just killing time or on an airplane, you can look those up, or you can see, you know, all the drafts of his screenplays for all the various motion pictures and television episodes that he wrote. And, as I was saying, about 4 years ago, the library had just approached me as, just in my capacity as a reporter at the Times, if I wanted to take a look, specifically at the papers, relating to Network. And they were just so, just fascinating and evocative. And certainly his voice and his spirit, his attitude were, you know, so alive still on those pages. And I mean, I wrote at the time, I think about a 2,000 word feature just on the papers and the sort of, you know, the evolution of Network that they suggested. And even in that amount of space, you can imagine you can only really kind of, you know, scratch the surface of what's there and the story that could still be told. And so, I mean, it just seemed like a very natural thing to want to, you know, follow that further in a book that would let me, on the one hand, tell Chayefsky's story and you know, the arc of his career, and Network is certainly the seminal work in it, but also to tie in these other storylines about how television evolved, from the start of his career to the point at which he writes Network, and how TV news changed so much, and how just the business of it and how audiences related to it, how much that had changed in, again, that same sort of 20-year span.
Of course, like we've already said, your first two books are autobiographical, and a lot of the other material you've written have been popular culture and probably more current type material. So how did it feel to actually, I mean, what was your experience in doing research in the past, having to actually sit down and just comb through this material? As a historian, I'm used to having to do research, and sometimes other people aren't as much. So I'm wondering whether what you felt and how did you find it interesting, enjoyable,
Sure. I mean, it's I mean, I was fortunate in a way that my, you know, at the time I undertook the sort of, you know, the real heavy duty library research that my wife at the time happened to be on a trip to Japan. She was working there for about 3 or 4 months, and I just had a lot of solo time on my hands. So I certainly didn't feel guilty about, you know, going to the library for, you know, 6 or 8 hours at a time and just, you know, calling in a couple of boxes and just working straight through them. I mean, it's very solitary, but it can also be very, you know, very pleasurable. And certainly to look at, you know, Chayefsky's papers in particular, I mean, it seems sort of obvious to say, but that, you know, this was an era when there were, you know, no personal computers, no digital devices of any kind. So any work that you did, I mean, it had to be committed to paper in some form. And so, that resulted in him leaving behind a very thorough archive, but he was also such a meticulous guy, I think partly out of habit and partly out of fears that later came true, fears that he was going to be sued or subpoenaed in some way. And so he just held on to everything. You have to do a little bit of, putting together the jigsaw puzzle yourself, but you can really see the evolution of the movie, you know, come together right before your eyes. And it was a movie that went through, many different iterations. He really was not the kind of guy who just, you know, came up with an idea and wrote the script and he was done. I mean, he really revised and rewrote, and really without a lot of external input. It wasn't as if he went to even his producing partner or whichever studios he happened to be writing for and said, you know, what do you think of this, and what notes do you have for me, and, you know, what suggestions could you make? When he felt that a script was done, it was done. But you could be fairly assured that by the time it got to you, it had gone through a lot of revision and rethinking and was in a pretty refined form at that point.
Yeah, you hear stories of which screenwriters or even playwrights who are of the opinion that who have the belief that I wrote the words, you say them exactly as I wrote them, and we know that he definitely was one of those in that school.
Oh, no, he's somebody who, quite frankly, you know, demanded it, insisted upon it, even to the point, I mean, on network, he was the rare screenwriter. I mean, it was part of his production deal. He was on set every single day, and not just watching from the wings or from behind the scenes, but he physically had himself positioned on set, you know, basically as close to the shooting as he could, as close to the action as he could be, so that he could watch the actors and make sure that they performed the dialogue exactly as he wrote it. And if you flubbed a line or a word, he would talk to the script supervisor and send the script supervisor over to you, and she would say, well, actually, you know, the line is this, or actually the word is this, and he would make sure that you said it as he wrote it.
Yeah, because you talk a lot about the film, the actual process, and the good thing is that not only did you have access to his materials, but you also were still able to talk to some of the people who were involved in the actual filming. So that probably helped to give an even more well-rounded description of what the process must have been like.
Certainly. I mean, you know, it's unfortunate that, I mean, again, as thorough as Chayefsky was, he himself did not keep a lot of notes or archival material on so much on the shooting of the movie, or, you know, I mean, you see some memos that he was looped in on, but fortunately a lot of the, you know, not so many of the cast members are still alive, although, you know, many of the supporting players still were, but also a lot of just the hands-on production people, and even, you know, Chayefsky's producing partner Howard Gottfried, who worked with him on network and on the hospital, he's still alive. And so, you know, just having access to many of those people, they certainly helped, fill in a lot of the blanks and really tell you, you know, day by day what occurred. Even, the woman who I mentioned who was the script supervisor, it was one of the very first, Hollywood motion pictures that she worked on, and she was really kind of awestruck just by, you know, the names of some of the cast members, and, you know, sort of a little dazzled by their celebrity. So she decided to keep a diary of every day on the film, and then in tracking her down, she said, you know, if you'd like to read my diaries or draw from them in any way, you're welcome to. And that was certainly a very helpful find.
Of course, sort of to fill in the rest of the story related to the writing, is that he received very high billing for a writer. If my memory is exactly correct, during the main titles, it's Network, and the next title is by Paddy Chayefsky.
Yes. I mean, that's about as high, basically, in terms of credit that you could receive. I mean, nowadays, what you usually see is, it will say a film by, and then the name of the director, that the director is perceived as the sort of the auteur of the project. And he was maybe one of the last screenwriters where it really was understood that this was his movie. And even though this is a film directed by Sidney Lumet, you know, one of the all-time great filmmakers, and a person who certainly put his personal stamp on every film he made, and his movies were very much his movies, he understood going into this that to some extent he was going to be playing second fiddle to Chayefsky, and his job was to help Chayefsky realize whatever vision he had.
Yeah, there was a period of time, and this goes even back into the 30s, 40s, and 50s, where the ultimate was getting your name above the title as far as the director. So, for example, Frank Capra was probably known as one of the first directors who regularly had his name, a film by, or Frank Capra's It's a Wonderful Life or whatever. And
Right. So
you're right, in this particular case, he pretty much is the highest billed person. I don't remember if there's any cast before him or not.
It depends. I mean, if you're looking, for example, at the opening credits, you'll still see, I'm pretty certain, you know, William Holden and Faye Dunaway and Peter Finch's name ahead of his. But, excuse me, see, if you look at certainly the way the film got written about, the way it was reviewed and covered in the press after it was released and became, kind of a sensation and kind of notorious, that everyone treated it as Chayefsky's film. And he also sort of had to bear the brunt of most of the criticism that was directed at him, the people's perception, not inaccurately, that, you know, it was very negatively disposed towards television, very negatively, you know, disposed towards TV news, that these were all, you know, his ideas, not, you know, Faye Dunaway or Holden, and then they did not necessarily have to, withstand the criticism that those ideas took in the way that Chayefsky did.
Obviously, he had large amounts of television experience, and did he feel that he was being realistic with some of the things he was trying to say, or did he mean it to be a satire, or did he really, what kind of a points was he trying to make?
Yeah, well, I think that his position on the film could certainly vacillate from day to day, and some days he would talk about it as a kind of way out satire, and on some days he would say, oh no, this is my prediction of exactly what's going to happen, as crazy as it seems. But I think the part that he was usually consistent on, the part that I think he did genuinely believe, is that, you know, to his mind, the movie was not solely about television. It was about what's happening to American society and people feeling disconnected from each other and feeling alienated, feeling like things are getting out of control and getting away from their ability to comprehend it or to have control over their own destinies. And for him, TV was just sort of the vehicle in which to tell that story. It was a world that he certainly had a lot of experience in, although he had to kind of relearn it to see how TV operated differently in the 70s than it did when he first broke through. But again, to his mind, he didn't feel that he was telling a story that was solely or specifically about TV, and I think he was really quite struck by how negatively you know, figures in the TV industry responded to the movie, how much they really kind of detested it. And that genuinely took him all by surprise. And it seems almost strange if you watch the movie, if you've ever watched the movie, to think, well, how could you be surprised that people like, you know, Walter Cronkite and John Chancellor would be upset by this movie? But the fact that Chayefsky really didn't see that reaction coming, it just shows you, I think, to the extent to which, you know, he really didn't see it being about television specifically. He seemed to think that people who worked in the industry would just kind of laugh it off, or they would think that they were somehow in on whatever kind of joke he was telling.
Well, that may be, I mean, don't hate to use the word, but he was probably being a little naive about that, because
name me
an interesting movie about the film industry. It's hard to find them, because it's, I think in the same concept, there people get a little bit they get possessive about their industries, and it doesn't matter what the movie is, if it seems to be sort of aimed at a particular industry, and you know, you often see complaining that maybe some people might say is a little out of unnecessary, but it's not a big surprise that people would have been upset about it, especially since the various, at least which of the networks gave him some space or allowed him to do some filming?
Yeah, well, they weren't able to do any filming at the American networks, because by that point, everyone had seen the script and they already were kind of wary of it. But when he was still in the research stages, he certainly spent extensive time both at NBC and at CBS, and also visited ABC as well. I mean, he certainly got to see the inner workings of all three networks, and even, you know, he spent time, I mean, both with Walter Cronkite, the CBS anchor, with John Chancellor, the NBC anchor. So they were both, and neither of them really had a sense at the time of what he was writing, in part because Chayefsky didn't know for sure what he was writing. So they had some good reason to be taken aback when the movie came out, and to realize, oh, in a way, I was sort of complicit in this. I helped this guy to basically stab me in the back, at least as far as they felt about it.
Of course, like you say, it is a perception issue. There's a lot of movies that have gotten probably unfair criticism because people look at the movie only from its most obvious without looking at the underlying themes. And in this case, you're absolutely right. The themes of alienation are come through quite clearly. We've got Howard Beale, who's alienated from the world and
right.
or from sanity. And then you've got William Holden, who's alienated from his life because he lost everything he had because work, and he lived so much for work. And then Faye Dunaway, who's alienated from emotion to an extent.
Right.
So
those are I think that's an excellent analysis of those principal characters and what's motivating them. And just to add to what you were saying, I mean, part of what was fascinating about working on this book was just to go back and see the reaction that greeted the movie at the time that it was released, because we certainly think of it as a classic now and an inarguably so. But you know, to look at the reviews that it got at the time, it was highly polarizing. I mean, there were quite a few reviews, including, I'm happy to say, in the New York Times, that were just, you know, raves. And then there were many others that were highly negative. And there were, you know, many opportunities in both in print and in television coverage for the news industry itself to criticize it. And they certainly made their feelings known. And then it went on to become a great commercial hit, I mean, at least at the scale at which it was made. And then, you know, it was also, something of a sensation at the Academy Awards that year. So that gave it a little bit more legitimacy. But it was not a given at the time. There were a lot of different ways it potentially could have gone. And so you sort of see how, as I think with many other movies, I mean, their status isn't really established until, you know, many years after their release, and that's when we can really sort of understand, you know, where they kind of fit into the larger pantheon. But you know, the immediate reaction that they receive is not always telling of, you know, where they're going to, you know, what their standing is going to be later on.
Of course, you mentioned your age. I'm 20 years older than you, so I did see Network when it first opened in the theaters. And one of the things, it may have received a lot of criticism, but what's interesting is back in the pre-internet days, you didn't always know the other criticism was going on, because depending on where you lived, you're only seeing local coverage, and if they didn't talk about it, you didn't really know it was always being criticized the same way. I remember going to see the movie and walking out saying it was in many ways like nothing I'd ever seen before, because of just the audaciousness, and I guess that's the best word I can use, of what was put up on the screen and what came out of his head.
Right. And, well, one person I can tell you that was probably paying attention to all this coverage was Chayefsky himself, and I think it really... he really took it to heart, that you know, he believed so strongly in the ideas that he felt it embodied, and also I think seemed to think that everybody would understand exactly what he was trying to say with the movie. So to whatever extent either he felt that people weren't embracing its messages or weren't fully understanding them, that really wounded him. And it's a really tough thing. I mean, on the one hand, to have the kind of platform that he had to, you know, to get his ideas out to as many people as he did, I mean, by the millions, and then really to think that every single one of those millions is going to grasp it in the way that you intended it, and to be so, you know, I think I just... to be that sensitive to that even you know, a handful of rejections or even a small percentage of negative feeling or misunderstanding or however you want to characterize it, to be so hurt by that, I mean, that's a very tough thing to experience on the scale that he did.
The other thing I'm thinking about, one maybe helped its popularity or the view of it, is that it came out just before the beginning of the home video revolution. Home video started to come in the early 80s, and I'm going to guess that it was probably, and I have no way of knowing this, I'd have to check, it was probably released on video pretty early on. And so I'm going to guess that it found, nowadays it's not unusual for movies, for theaters, you know, studios and producers care more about the aftermarket than they do about the main market. And
yeah. Well, certainly one thing that they were very concerned about with this is that, you know, a big part of, you know, before they were, you know, before they learned that, or that, before it came to pass that it was, you know, a commercial success in and of itself in its theatrical release, you know, they were concerned about being able to later show it on television. And, you know, that part of the way that they could make some of their money back is by licensing it. I mean, there weren't really cable channels to show it on at that point. They couldn't necessarily think about, well, HBO or, you know, pay-per-view, things like that, but to show it on one of the major networks, that was a way to, you know, you can make a couple of million dollars right there. And this was a movie they were very fearful. I mean, within the studios themselves, at MGM and United Artists, they were looking at this movie, which is so critical of television and has, you know, so many four-letter words in it, and thinking, how are we ever going to get this shown on television?
Well, you can, certain films, it got to a point, and I'm not sure if you mentioned this at all on Network or whether it was done in any way, shape, or form, but I know there was, after a while, certain, a producer might consider, okay, we're going to, they would refilm scenes knowing full well that that's for television, and or they would make sure that certain scenes where there was a lot of foul language, the person swearing's back was to the camera so they could dub it without it being obvious.
That was definitely not done in this case, and they did have to make certain edits with how it was shown on television. For example, I mean, the very famous love scene between William Holden and Faye Dunaway, that definitely was not shown on the CBS broadcast. But one thing that's kind of surprising, they did allow a few of the obscene words in the film to be broadcast on network television when the film was first shown. It's sort of a funny thing to think about, and probably wouldn't even fly today, certainly not in a kind of post Janet Jackson Nipplegate environment, but that they actually made a few they made a few exceptions here, because the feeling was that the obscene language was sort of integral to the story and to the scenes that they applied to. There was just no way around it, and would even be sort of insulting to the intelligence of the audience to change those instances. And you could never imagine a network censor or executive thinking that way today.
In fact, I'd say in many ways things have gone reverse when you think about NYPD Blue and what it did for television, and how nowadays you wouldn't get anything close to that.
No, not at all. It's certainly not on broadcast
TV,
network,
right. Cable different, cable. But you're right.
Yes, exactly.
So let's talk about the casting. Obviously, you go into a lot of depth about that, which I found fascinating, because that's the part where sometimes that I think can. When you then watch a movie and you think what was going on in the background. So, for example, the most obvious casting issue in the entire film was Faye Dunaway. Obviously,
she was sort of the easiest one to come by, and I think sort of a great stroke of luck. I mean, she was very near the top, or if not at the top of their lists for the Diana Christensen role. I mean, she was on such a huge hot streak at the time. I mean, she'd had a kind of rise and fall already, if you think back to Bonnie and Clyde, and then, never really having a great follow-up to that until she made Chinatown, which is many, many years later. But certainly by the mid-70s, I mean, she's, as hotly in demand as you can imagine. And the fact that she was interested in making the movie, that gave them a certain amount of breathing room. They gave them one star, gave the film itself a little bit of cachet, but certainly not guarantee that every other role would be as easy to fill.
Then, though, during the filming, there were probably days that some people felt, gee, I wish it hadn't been so easy to get Faye Dunaway. And you talk about that quite a bit.
Yeah. Yes, she certainly gave, I think, probably the hardest time of all. But in some ways, she and Chayefsky were kind of perfectly matched that way, that she also, was as attuned to her own performance in the way that Chayefsky was attuned to his writing. It certainly was working in an era, as the movie itself is sort of illustrating, at a time when women were just not taken as seriously in leadership positions, or they were given control very warily, if at all. And so the idea that you had a leading actress on a very male dominated project in terms of the other creative positions, and she was somebody who had very strong opinions about anything that she performed, any lines of dialogue, had a lot of personal trouble, with the nudity that was called for in the love scene with William Holden. And so these all became, points of contention as the shooting went on. And she was not really given a lot of, certainly not a lot of leeway to make her opinions known.
I wonder, I don't know that you would know either, but does she have more foul language than anybody else? Or did he purposely give the woman just to push the fact that here was a woman trying to be in a man's world, so to speak? And sometimes, I don't know, I don't really know the answer to that, but there's just something.
Yeah, I have to go back and sit and count. I don't, off the top of my head, I don't know. There are a few. There's a few pretty harsh moments that I can also think of that William Holden has. So he might give her a run for her money.
Yeah, that's true. But then, of course, the other person that's probably the person who's probably most well known from Network for a variety of reasons, including sure. The Aftermath, is Peter Finch.
Absolutely.
His career, he didn't have much of a career prior that the average person wouldn't have known who Peter Finch was very much prior to Network. And he saw Network, or maybe they did, I don't, the earlier period. But Network was supposed to be, or what was supposed to turn out to be his way back up.
Yeah, it would have been, certainly would have been, his comeback vehicle had he lived. And, he was somebody that they came to, certainly, quite reluctantly, really as a kind of a last ditch. The role of Howard Beale was, if they could have, they would have liked to cast that first, because they understood that was really the central character, or at least so much depended on who you got to play that role. And all of the people that they thought of as their sort of top choices, their dark horses, their last resorts, everybody had turned them down. Everyone from Chayefsky made a personal appeal to Paul Newman to see if he'd play the part. They thought of people like Walter Matthau. So many different names you could imagine, people who were very popular in that era, all the kind of leading men of that time. And it was just such a the project was in that character was such a sort of a third rail in a way he had a lot of really tough monologues. The character said a lot of really kind of crazy things, or just very pointed things. Also had his share of foul language, and so for all those reasons, as respected as Chayefsky was at the time, a lot of people just didn't want to even touch it. And by the time they get to Peter Finch, he's living basically in semi-retirement in Jamaica after having had this very long motion picture career in the United Kingdom and having done a lot of stage work there and just getting scripts sent to him, very occasionally. But this was one that he was willing to come back to the U.S. and to New York to make. And I think just the fact that A, he was open to do it, and B, he could do a kind of passable American accent, that was really all that they needed to hear at the time. And they really signed him up very quickly because I think they were just so close to their shooting schedule at that point. They just needed somebody.
Well, of course, it's one of the things that comes out in that you needed, now that the film's been made and obviously is viewable, you needed somebody who was as strong as the other two characters, because it really was a love triangle to an extent. And they,
sure.
Both William Holden's character and Faye Dunaway's character both loved Howard Beale, but for different reasons.
Right. And they're sort of struggling over him and over, what kind of an anchor and what kind of a newscaster is he going to be?
And being, since he's strong, a strong enough actor, he obviously is able to be as important in that sense. And of course, as you've pointed out, it was The Aftermath, and I was going to come up to the Academy Awards, since they were so controversial for a variety of reasons, and Chayefsky got involved in that too.
Sure.
It was, and this is one thing I do remember, in early 1977, as they were coming up to the Academy Awards after he had passed away, was the big controversy is, would the Academy give the award to a posthumous award, which they hadn't done before?
Right, certainly not in the acting category. That had never happened before. And just to fill in some of the detail, that Finch died in the course of the Academy campaign for the movie, in the course of promoting the film. Some time had elapsed between the making of the movie and its release. That it was shot in the winter of 1976, and by the time the autumn of 76 is approaching, it's released, basically in November and December of that year, and really starts to, pick up a lot of steam at that time in terms of critical reaction, and just audience reaction, commercial reaction. And as it emerges as a potential Oscar contender, that just meant, at least a need for a lot more promotion. And there were very few people, who could, who were sort of, at hand to provide that. That, you know, William Holden was off doing other work, and Faye Dunaway didn't really help out too much, you know, in terms of, you know, she did a couple of magazine features, but, you know, couldn't really do the sort of, you know, the day-to-day stuff that was required, even in the 70s. And we think now of Oscar campaigns and how sort of ubiquitous and unending they are now. But in 76, it was not all that different. And so the only people they really had who could put in that level of commitment were Chayefsky himself and Peter Finch. And he was happy to do it because he understood that this was, you know, his opportunity to get back into Hollywood and to work more reliably again. But, you know, he died. He collapsed, you know, in a hotel in Los Angeles waiting. He and Sidney Lumet are waiting to be picked up for a TV appearance that morning. And he, you know, basically dies of heart failure that day. And then he's nominated for Best Actor a short while later.
Right. And of course, like I say, the run up to the actual Academy Awards would the Oscars, you know, would he actually get the award? And then there was a controversy going on as to who was going to accept it if he won. You go into a lot of detail about that in the book.
Well, what a lot of people probably did not know at the time, but was certainly known within the industry, is that, you know, Peter Finch's wife, Aletha, was black. And so...
and not American either.
Right. Oh, well, at that point, you know, she was, you know, I mean, she was from Jamaica and living in America, and there were certainly a lot of rumors kicked up about, you know, her immigration status or legal status, as, you know, as far as, you know, was she even allowed to be in the country at the time? And that was sort of part of, I suppose, the smear campaign to not allow her to, you know, to accept the award on her late husband's behalf. There's any number of sort of explanations as to why the Academy might have been opposed to the idea of her accepting. I mean, there certainly is, you know, the issue of race is certainly the most likely reason. And just in the notion of, you know, having a black woman except for a white man, that was something they still could not countenance. And there had been so few, you know, black recipients of Oscars to that point. It wasn't going to make them look good as an institution. And, you know, she was an outspoken woman and a woman who could kind of shoot from the hip. And there was some fear as to what she might actually say if she got up to the podium and did it. And, you know, Chayefsky and his producer Howard Gottfried, they had to kind of engage in a bit of subterfuge. They had to, you know, they basically struck this plan. They told the Academy, if Finch is named as the winner, then Chayefsky himself will go up and accept the award for him. And that, if you go back and you watch the ceremony, that's what starts to happen. That, you know, Finch is announced as the winner, and the audience applauds, and you even hear the voiceover announcer say, you know, accepting the award on behalf of Peter Finch is Paddy Chayefsky. And Chayefsky does go up there at first, but as soon as he gets to the podium, he says, you know, I shouldn't even be here. And the person who should be accepting this award is Mrs. Peter Finch. And he invites Aletha Finch to come out from the audience and come up to the stage. And then she gives, you know, a very touching and very tearful short speech, you know, the speech that she thought that her husband would have given had he won. And it's a really beautiful moment. It's hard not to really get broken up at even today if you watch it. But to think about, you know, all the, you know, the roadblocks that were in trying to get in the way of that moment is also kind of extraordinary to think about.
Of course, Chayefsky's other controversy from that year's Academy Awards was his response to Vanessa Redgrave's.
Yeah. Right. That was actually the following year.
Oh, that's right. Although, it was the following year. You're right.
But most people do seem to think now, I mean, these incidents were only a year apart. You know, and Chayefsky was invited back to the ceremony the following year to present an award, this time because he had won the previous year. And there was a lot of controversy over Redgrave, who was a nominee for the movie Julia, but who was also a producer of a documentary called The Palestinian, which you know, interviewed Arafat, interviewed other Palestinians, which many, you know, it's not, it, you know, it, people have their different perspectives on the movie, but the perception of the film was that it was very pro-Palestinian and sort of, you know, to almost the exclusion of, you know, Israel's point of view. And, you know, there was a lot of protesting of the Oscars that year. And certainly, you know, then when, you know, Redgrave did use her acceptance speech early on in the show to talk about, you know, what she had faced in terms of the protest response, and, you know, was critical of the people protesting her very presence, you know, at the award ceremony. There was no way that Chayefsky felt that he couldn't respond to that in his own remarks later in the show. And that just became a kind of defining moment in his life. If people remember him for anything, if people remember him even for writing Network, they remember him as the guy who gave this kind of pugnacious speech at the Oscars.
So, of course, you're a popular culture writer. How prophetic was Network, in your
opinion? Well, I mean, of course, as the author of this book, I certainly feel that it was highly prophetic. I mean, if you think about, for example, the fact that, you know, he's writing this in an era when there was no such thing as reality television, and he basically predicts this idea that, you know, notorious public figures, in his movie, the actual domestic terrorists are going to be given their own reality show. I mean, that did come true to a certain extent. Not that we give terrorists their own television programs, but that there is such a thing now as reality TV, and you know, that you know, sort of the more you know, awful or notorious a person, the better a reality star you make. But the certainly the much larger idea that he got right is just the breakdown of television broadcasting and TV news as a kind of bellwether of that the transition or the collapse from kind of, you know, straightforward you know, fact-based news anchors to a world that's dominated not even by just opinion, but by, you know, by spleen and by, you know, whoever can sort of deliver the most impassioned and you know, bilious you know, commentary on the news. Those are the figures that prevail. I mean, that's something that you know, he very much anticipated with the movie, and just the larger breakdown of mass media, the arrival of the internet, something that, you know, was, you know, no one knew about in 1976. That was, even though there's no presence of, you know, digital or electronic media really in the film, the idea that he is talking about how the more sophisticated media becomes and the more it, on the one hand, seems to empower people and allows everyone to have a voice and have a stake and you know, have themselves known, you know, in our public discourse, the more it actually sort of drives people apart from one another, and the more alienated it makes them feel, the more removed, you know, it kind of makes them in our larger conversation. And that's certainly something that the internet has borne out.
Of course, the other part that I see prophetic, that he hit it right on the button, obviously, is corporate ownership of the media companies. And
very
how
true.
And how corporate ownership became important to news, because suddenly the amount of money that was being lost or being spent on news became an important aspect of looking at the bottom line. And some of the scenes with Robert Duvall in particular, they seemed jarring at the time, but it's a given now. And then the amount of money that the networks were spending for, you know, foreign bureaus and everything else, that nowadays just doesn't happen because of the costs involved and the fact that news is supposed to be at least break even, if not make money.
Right, and the idea that, you know, news itself would basically be, you know, run by the kind, you know, I mean, the film is sort of fearful of the idea that somehow, you know, the entertainment division of the network is going to take over a news show, and that certainly happened to varying degrees. But even the fact that, you know, news has to sort of operate, you know, by the same standards as entertainment in terms of, as you say, you know, being profitable, delivering ratings, being, you know, not merely a public service, but, you know, entertaining people or being widely watched. You know, I mean, all of that's occurred.
And I remember, and I'd have to look up to find out when it was, but Rune Arledge was given, as a sport, he was a sports producer and was given control over the news division at one point at ABC. And I remember that was an incredible, you know, there was incredible anger about the fact that this entertainer was suddenly going to be in charge of the news.
Right, right. And you know, it's one of the things that I write about in the book that was sort of happening, you know, contemporaneously with the movie. I mean, the movie is so much about the idea of, you know, this just fear or antipathy of there being, you know, a prominent, you know, female news executive or, you know, a television executive who happens to be female. And this is all happening at the same time that, you know, Barbara Walters is being recruited to be, you know, one of the first, you know, female television news anchors. And just the kind of, you know, the resistance that she ran into, and just the bile that was directed at her for, you know, certainly being a woman, and even the perception that she was somebody who had come from the world of entertainment and not, you know, true journalism, that somehow made her, you know, less of a, you know, an appropriate person to hold the job.
I was actually able to quickly check, thanks to the internet. He became president in 1977, so it was right after Networks came out, and one of the first things he did was when Barbara Walters was made co-anchor. And so it is interesting that we got prophecy came down almost right away. So it was interesting. So anyway, so going forward now, obviously you've spent a good portion of the last number of years of your life working on a book on film. And I asked you early on, if you didn't mind me asking. So obviously, going forward, you have another project going on right now that definitely relates to entertainment again. What is that project?
Right. So I've been working on a biography of Robin Williams, who, of course, was a tremendous entertainer in a number of different fields. And, you know, motion pictures were a big part of his career, as was television, as was stand-up comedy. I mean, those are all worlds that, you know, I'm you know, endlessly fascinated with. And he was just a particular hero and icon of mine, and somebody who I, you know, just had the tremendous privilege of getting to write about on a few occasions, you know, when he was alive, and who really, you know, I'm not going to pretend that he would even remember who I was, but that, you know, gave me a lot of access and entree into his life, and was, I found, just a very warm and open person. And, yeah, I think someone that a lot of us just miss tremendously.
Well, it's great to know that you can work on a project like that and still write extensively for the newspaper. So I hope that people...
I hope my editors feel the same way.
Well, that's good. Well, as I say, I hope people take the time not only to read this book, but I think follow your writing, because you do have a good view of culture, and you bring across great insight, and like I say, I really appreciate that you took the time to talk to me today. And the book is great, the film is too, so definitely deserve to be checked out again. And thanks again.
Thank you.
And have a good rest of your day.
Oh, thanks, it was my pleasure, and I'm happy to ride Paddy Chayefsky's coattails when when I have the opportunity.
Great, thanks.
All right, thanks again.
Thanks to Dave Itzkoff for joining me. I hope you will follow him through his New York Times writing and on Twitter at @DItzkoff. This is Joel Cherney, and I will be back soon with more new books in film.